From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This program is made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners. We're very thankful for that and for you as a listener. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, February 14th marks the Christian feast of St. Valentine, celebrated universally as a day of love. February 15th is Nirvana Day for followers of Buddhism and the Jain religion, as well as Transfiguration Sunday for Christians, who then mark Shrove Tuesday on the 17th. Ash Wednesday starts the 40 days of Lent leading up to the Christian celebration of Easter, and Thursday brings the Chinese New Year. Get ready for the Year of the Goat. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief radio show.
Our nation's in trouble, and our nation's in trouble because we have put other things before God.
If you are forced to violate your conscience to do work, that's slavery. If you are forced to violate your conscience, that is tyranny. That's the gay Gestapo.
Get to this moderate form of Islam if it exists.
Whether it's bigoted attempts to conflate terror groups with Islam hijacking our national security debate, bigoted attempts to invoke religious liberty to fight LGBT rights defining today's culture wars, sectarian prayer breakfasts, discrimination against atheists, front and center in the crucial struggle to preserve our Constitution in the face of these short-sighted efforts to pit one group against another, is Interfaith Alliance, defending faith and freedom for all Americans. On this week's show, we'll discuss the Alliance's agenda for 2015 with Executive Director Jack Moline.
Without God, there could be no American form of government, nor an American way of life. Recognition of the Supreme Being is the first expression of Americanism.
Our founders and our founding documents meant, they're quite clear, that we would create law based on the God of the Bible and the Ten Commandments. It's pretty simple.
You only have a limited government when you understand the Bible, because God gives a specific jurisdiction to government. It's not to get out of that jurisdiction, and only if you have that Bible teaching do you have limited government.
With several award-winning book titles to his credit, Dr. Peter Manceau is an influential thinker and educator whose latest book is One Nation Under God's A New American History. With the David Bartons and Texas school boards of the world busily rewriting our collective past in a disingenuous and self-serving way, this book could not have come at a better time. It's a profound book, and you'll meet the author on this week's State of Belief. But first,
did they stop with one man and one man, or one woman and one woman? Or do they go to multiple marriages? Or do they go to marriages between men and their daughters, or women and their sons?
We've become accustomed to the way the issue of marriage equality has returned to the headlines again and again in the past couple of years. Various courts keep overturning state bans and expanding access for more and more same-sex couples, even as angry conservatives try to pound this square peg into the round hole of religious liberty. The matter's taken some strange and troubling turns this past week in Alabama as the U.S. Supreme Court prepares to hear oral arguments on marriage equality this April. I'm happy to be joined once again by writer and activist Jay Michelson. Jay, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's always good to be here, Ron. Thank you.
In a nutshell, a federal judge ruled Alabama's anti-marriage amendment unconstitutional, something that has opened the door to equality in a number of other states. But Roy Moore, Chief Justice in Alabama, took a very unusual step in response. Jay, you're an attorney, and your Daily Beast article is headlined, "Is Alabama Anti-Gay Judge on the Right Side of the Law?" So I'm going to ask you to explain that, if you will.
Many of us would agree that Chief Justice Moore is on the wrong side of history, but he did use a very clever kind of legal technicality to try a last-ditch effort, kind of a Hail Mary pass, to stop marriage equality in Alabama. What he said was that the probate judges who actually issue marriage licenses were not part of the lawsuit that found that marriage amendment unconstitutional. And therefore, they're not technically bound by it. The only people who are bound by it was the Attorney General, the executive branch of the Alabama state government. And guess who's responsible ultimately for all the probate judges? Well, Chief Justice Roy Moore himself. So he said that this lawsuit actually doesn't cover judges. It only covers the Attorney General. And since you probate judges report to me, Roy Moore, I'm telling you not to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couples.
So will that work?
Well, it's worked so far. As we've seen in Alabama, it's now a patchwork of jurisdictions. Some probate judges are following the district court order and have issued marriage licenses to all comers, same-sex, opposite-sex alike. And others have followed Justice Moore. And there are counties in Alabama where you still cannot marry if you're of the same sex under the law. And so that tactic has worked in a limited way.
What has been the effect that you know about on same-gender couples in Alabama?
There's been reports, actually, of an arrest of a minister who conducted a same-sex wedding in one of the places where it was not legal to do so. We're still kind of in a holding pattern. I grew up in Florida, and I watched that space battle. This is kind of similar. The everything in the kitchen sink approach, just try anything to somehow stop this historic change from taking place. And, you know, I think if you actually look at which counties are and which are not issuing the marriage licenses, most of the same-sex couples are in counties where they can get the license. You know, I think it's just a case of maybe justice delayed, but not really justice denied, because this is just a couple of months until we'll have a definitive answer.
The U.S. Supreme Court declined to get involved in Alabama 7-2. Does that give us any insight into what we might see from the court later in this session on marriage at the federal level?
It does. It was a very interesting ruling. First, I think it is a little surprising that the court did not issue a stay pending their resolution of this issue. So that tells you something. Second, if you read Justice Thomas's angry dissent, he sort of signals that, in his opinion, the justices are planning to find a constitutional right for marriage for everybody, and so that's why they didn't take this up, and they shouldn't do that. So that's only one justice's opinion, and he may just be, you know, grumbling and complaining. But if we take him at his word, then that denial by the Supreme Court does actually speak volumes.
Jay, this past week you wrote in the Daily Beast about Kansas Governor Sam Brownback's action on employment protections for LGBT workers. To quote your piece, what's going on?
Well, this is just part of the same trend. You know, I mentioned a second ago that this is kind of the Hail Mary stage of conservative opposition to LGBT equality. And, you know, I think Governor Brownback's decision is an even more desperate Hail Mary than Chief Justice Moore's. There was an executive order issued by Governor Sebelius, actually, who later, of course, went on to be Secretary of Health and Human Services, extending non-discrimination protection to LGBT state employees. And it's interesting, you know, these provisions, if you think about it, maybe even from a religious or a moral perspective, they enjoy much more support than same-sex marriage does. People, you know, even, you know, non-bigoted people, people who are really working their way through this issue, are still in process thinking about same-sex marriage. But when it comes to the question, should you be fired because you're gay or lesbian, you know, it's like 80-90% of Americans say no. And that, I think, goes to the sort of basic fair-mindedness of the mainstream of America. And it's going against that Governor Brownback issued that order. And he's saying that the state should be able, if I were to come out as gay and I worked for the state of Kansas, that would be grounds for me to be fired. And I think that rubs most people the wrong way.
Sure. The president sustained a whole lot of noisy response to his words at the presidential prayer breakfast regarding the history of violence in the name of religion. You wrote about this for Religion News Service, and NBC's Meet the Press picked up on your words. Summarize the point you're making on that.
I think the president's point was quite clear, that all religions have the capacity of being abused by those seeking to do violence. And that's true for every religion in the world. Just to pick a less controversial example, people think of the Dalai Lama, for example, as like the symbol of Buddhism. But there are Buddhist fundamentalists in Burma right now who are perpetrating all kinds of discrimination against the Muslim minority in Burma. You know, every religion can be turned for good or for evil. that to me is not only a non-controversial point, but I think it's a very important religious teaching that none of our traditions are above being abused, and so we have to always be vigilant for that happening. But God forbid anybody would say anything negative about Christianity, especially someone that 25% of Americans still don't believe is a Christian. So there's been a huge hue and cry on the sort of wingnut sector of the right, saying that Obama's picking on Christians, all Christians are no different from ISIS. And, of course, none of that's true. I think he was actually making a very important theological point, but it's one that some people just didn't want to hear.
You present some remarkable numbers. Talk about some of the most important ones in a historical context.
You know, the estimates of the number of dead in the Crusades, including the Crusaders, are somewhere between 1.1 and 3 million people. And that constituted at the time, you know, over 1% of the world population. And that would be, you know, now like 34 million people perishing over a 200-year period as a result of religious violence. 34 million people. You know, this was not a small blip. There were massacres that took place. I'm a Jewish and a rabbi, and, you know, one of the worst massacres in Jewish history until the 20th century took place as part of the Crusades, the Rhineland massacres in 1096. This was an extraordinarily painful, bloody, and I think dark period in the history of the church, and generations of Christians have recognized that and have taken lessons from it. What we've seen just in this last little period have actually been people apologizing and saying, oh, and actually the Crusades were great. Let's not give Christians a bad name by talking about them.
You know, Jay, all religions have the capacity to get sick. When that happens, seldom do the people involved in that deterioration of religion see that happening. They don't see what's going on in their own lives. Why is that?
You know, it is really strange. I mean, let's take a more recent example than the Crusades. You know, think about the civil rights struggles of the 20th century. When the Ku Klux Klan was at the height of its popularity in the 1920s, 15% of white male Americans were members of that organization. Mm. I did a sort of statistical study of how many Muslims worldwide support terrorism today, and that number is about 12%. In other words, it's pretty close. The KKK membership in the United States among eligible members was basically the same number as the number of Muslims who actually support some kind of religious violence. This is a problem that spans all religious traditions. So, you know, when we look at the civil rights struggle in America, there are the Christians on the KKK, and then there were the Christians marching with Dr. King. I think some people would like to say, well, the KKK weren't really Christians. But the KKK people themselves thought that they were.
Sure.
You know, the reality is that all religions equally, Judaism also, of course, can be used to violent ends when certain of the tradition's teachings are emphasized at the expense of others. You know, fortunately, when we go to the real fundamentals, you know, love thy neighbor as thyself, for example, we don't see these kinds of nasty teachings, but they're there in every tradition.
Yeah. I can't deny that I'm deeply troubled by the predictable focus on everything except what I believe the president was saying or trying to say. Any religion can be misapplied in attempting to justify evil. Conservatives condemned him for allegedly failing to label terrorists as Islamic. You have to know your enemy before you can defeat him, they cry. Here Obama was identifying the timeless human vulnerability to delusional abuse of religion as the ultimate enemy, and it's like nobody heard it.
Not only did nobody hear him, but they went on continuing in the response to the president, continuing to preach the kind of hateful messages that he was talking about. The more Americans think that we're at war, Christianity is at war with Islam, that's an incredibly dangerous, hateful, and really worrisome idea. Right? We are at war with a kind of Islamic extremism or religious extremism or abuse of Islam in the name of extremism, you know, however you want to name it, with whatever language. Yes, there is a battle going on. But that battle is against extremism. It's not one religion against another. It's about fundamentalism and the abuse of religion. And so to see people respond to that message with actually more abuse of religion and more Islamophobia and more anti-Muslim comments is deeply disheartening. But I think it's just easier for a lot of folks to see the world in terms of black and white.
But Jay, more broadly, a man named Barack Hussein Obama walks into a prayer breakfast sponsored by the Christianist group, The Fellowship,
What possibly could go wrong?
Yeah, exactly. There has been some interesting commentary about what was the president thinking? What did he think the reaction would be? Not that he's wrong necessarily, but you pick your message for your audience. But I think the message was carefully chosen. You know, this is a president in the second half of his second term. He's not trying to curry favor. He's trying to call things as he sees them. And the trend of extremist Christianity that we've seen, or the abuse of Christianity by political extremists, is really troubling. And I think it was a courageous act, some would say a foolhardy act, I would say a courageous act, to both condemn ISIS, as he very clearly did, but also say, let's not get confused about this problem. We've also had this problem in earlier times in our history.
Rabbi J. Michelson is an attorney, an author, an activist, a friend who writes prolifically for The Daily Beast, Religion News Service, and The Forward, among other publications. He's the author of the terrific book, God Versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality. Jay, you do such valuable work. Thank you for taking time to be with us and to enlighten the people who listen to this show. It's always good to have you on, and we appreciate it.
Thank you, and thank you for doing the work that you do, too. I really appreciate it, and I am a fan.
One, two, three, four.
Rabbi Jack Moline has hit the ground running in his first weeks as executive director of Interfaith Alliance, and no wonder. There's no shortage of areas of concern for the Alliance's membership, both in the headlines and behind the scenes in the nation's capital. So I am very happy to welcome Rabbi Moline back for what will be, I'm glad to say, an ongoing series of conversations here on State of Belief Radio. Jack, welcome.
It's always a pleasure to be talking to you, Welton, wherever it is.
Thanks, man. With so many different things happening in our country that directly impact religious freedom right now, I'm curious as to what's on top of everything else on your desk.
My laptop, but what's on my laptop is what's important. We were just fascinated by what happened in Alabama this week. On the 50th anniversary of Bloody Sunday, or almost exactly, we have a situation in which the government of the state of Alabama is once again defying the federal courts in their instructions about extending civil rights to a disadvantaged group. The lovely thing about this for us, Welton, is because of all the good work that you've done, everyone's on our side now. And so there's very little Interfaith Alliance has to do to persuade anybody. We're just sort of watching this unfold and getting ready to be as supportive of people who want to formalize their love for each other according to the Constitution.
So are there specific plans related to that, or you're just being sensitive to where the dynamics are and where you can respond, you will?
So here's the best news I can give you.
Okay.
When this news came down, we were all prepared to get together a group of pastors from around the country to go to Alabama and be available for officiating at same-sex marriages. And I called a couple of friends of mine down there, and they said, there's no need. They are so excited to be able to extend these rights and privileges to people in Alabama that there's no shortage of pastors, of rabbis, of ministers who are willing to officiate at these ceremonies. So we were very happy that the people of Alabama really are behind this.
Oh, that is great news. I guess Judge Moore may be more alone than he knows.
You know, I remember my encounters with the good judge over the Ten Commandments issue a number of years ago, and I know he's a man of deep personal principle. He seems to be having a little trouble distinguishing his opinions from the Constitution.
Jack, how can we best diminish the power of divisiveness along religious lines that is such a powerful force in our nation right now?
We live in a period of change, and change is upsetting to people, even when it's change for the better, and they look to familiar forms and ideas to give them a sense of stability in a churning sea. What we have to do, and those of us who are in the clergy have a special responsibility, what we have to do is reassure people that what seems to be change to them is really progress. And if we can help deliver that message from a faith-based perspective to persuade them that just because things were always done this way doesn't mean that they will always be done this way, I think if we can do that, we will have not only created a better society for America, we will have each of us in our own way fulfilled the mandates of our philosophies and our faith.
I realize there is a long and important history of Jewish openness to interreligious cooperation. Can you identify where that comes from, and can it help inform the importance of the kind of work you're now doing?
You can see both trends for religious communities in America in the history of Jews and their relations with other faith communities. When you're a minority, as Jews have been everywhere for the past 2,000 years, except in the last almost 70 years, the State of Israel, when you're a minority, you have to find a way to go along to get along. And there are really two ways to do that. One is to build up walls around you and to isolate yourself and to feel that you're protecting something that will be compromised and maybe even sullied by contact with other groups. And the other is to trust that what you have is so sustaining that it will only benefit from your contact with other groups. What you've seen of cooperation from the Jewish community with other faith communities and social movements is an illustration of that latter description. But we have our communities, too, as do Christians and Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists, who feel that it's important to shut the outside world out and to maintain an integrity within. I think part of the problem we have as the Interfaith Alliance is that some of those groups are now trying to legislate that insularity and use it as a means of discriminating against other minorities whose practices they don't agree with.
Yeah, yeah. Do you see a bias against any reference to religion in progressive advocacy circles? Certainly, many initiatives are built on morality that's directly connected to core beliefs, including religious beliefs for many people. But what's the language that we need to help make that connection explicit? Because I'm afraid that too often we continue to cede the language of faith and freedom to the right.
Oh, I think you're absolutely right, Welton. And I think that our fear of being identified with the people who have misconstrued the language of faith is having a chilling effect on the rhetoric that we're willing to use. I'm completely unembarrassed, and I hope any person of faith who has progressive values is unembarrassed, to say that the mandate that I feel to act on behalf of the well-being of my fellow citizens and my fellow children of God comes from within my faith tradition. It's not a repudiation of that. It is, in fact, a fulfillment of it. It's the prophetic motive in the Jewish tradition, and one that I hope we admirably pursue. But because we've gotten nervous about people who are thumping their pulpits or who are using inflammatory approaches to social issues in the language of faith, we've become a little afraid to use that language, and I think that there are people who are hostile to religion, particularly in the progressive community, who are willing to take advantage of that and use it as a means of disparaging anybody who professes religious faith.
Yeah, yeah. Jack, I from the very beginning of Interfaith Alliance, there has always been an election year program, and most of the time that election year program was launched at the beginning of a presidential election year for sure, and off-year elections to a lesser degree. Listening to people stepping in, throwing their hats into the ring to be considered as a candidate for the presidency this next time around is beginning so early that I'm wondering what you're thinking about dealing with the whole relationship between religion and politics and the manipulation of politics and religion on each other. Are you going to have to do that even earlier than you thought?
We may very well have to do it earlier than we thought, but we're not going to advance our timetable just because there are people who can't hold their tongues about their aspirations until an appropriate moment. We've already started talking to some younger and articulate scholars in the various religious communities that make up our nation about coming together to write and to discuss the intersection of civic responsibilities and their own religious faith, their own faith communities, to interact with each other and to be able to present to America a case for being both faithful and civically active. And I'm hoping to get that up and running sooner rather than later. But the urgency I feel is because of the urgency of the issue, mm-hmm. not because there are a dozen people who are lining up to get their name first on the ballot somewhere.
Well said. I do have to ask you, and this is just personal, has God told you yet who ought to be president?
Yes, but unfortunately I told him I wasn't available, so we're just going to have to wait and see who else is around.
Jack, Interfaith Alliance sponsors this radio program, State of Belief Radio. Every week, I urge listeners to join the Alliance. At the end of every broadcast, I say you need to get on the website and join Interfaith Alliance today. But look, you're here today, and so I want to give you the time to make the pitch directly to State of Belief listeners, the pitch for getting involved in the crucial work of Interfaith Alliance.
Thank you very much. So here's what I would say to listeners. Those of you who know about State of Belief, those of you who know about the extraordinary work that Weldon Gaddy has done through Interfaith Alliance and through this broadcast, know that there is no voice for faith and freedom like us in the country. We are not a huge organization. We don't have the resources of a national political party, and we don't have the aspirations of any particular denomination, evangelical with a small e or otherwise. But we are a unique and important voice that defends the rights of people of faith to be as unencumbered as possible by government and to defend the government from being unencumbered by the expressions of faith that would interfere with the free practice of democracy by American citizens. Only by your support are we able to continue that work. And your membership is certainly much appreciated. Your contributions over and above basic membership levels help to support us. And if there is something that we can be doing with the resources that you can provide, we'd love to hear from you and we'd love to talk to you about dedicating some projects in your locality and nationally to defending faith from freedom, freedom from faith, and the wonderful interaction that can be for the benefit of all of us.
Jack Moline would love to hear from you, and one of the best messages you could send is that you're joining the numbers of people all over the United States who are supporters of Interfaith Alliance. Jack Moline has served as a congregational rabbi for over 30 years, most recently at the Gudas Akim Congregation in Alexandria, Virginia. Having held a number of leadership positions for numerous Jewish interfaith and community organizations, Jack is the new executive director for Interfaith Alliance. Jack, I'm looking forward to more conversations broadcast on State of Belief.
I can't wait myself. Well, thanks for having me on again.
Dr. Peter Manceau is an award-winning author and speaker. He's just published a compelling new book titled One Nation Under God's A New American History. And I am so pleased to welcome Peter Manceau to State of Belief Radio. Peter, welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
We've been seeing an ongoing revisionist push to Christianize every aspect of American history, complete with squeezing the words of the founders into a contemporary conservative frame. So your book could not have come at a better time, but you go all the way back to 1492. What did you find there?
The book really began at that moment a few years ago when there was this debate raging about whether or not the United States was founded as a Christian nation. And I am really not one for arguments. I'm a storyteller. And so I felt that those arguments on both sides left a lot of the diversity of American religious history untold. So it was a way of counteracting what we were hearing a few years ago. I wanted just to tell all these other stories as a way of opening up the narrative of what religion has been mm-hmm. to America. Mm-hmm. And so I did start 500 years ago because I wanted to show the ways in which the religious differences of Europe were imported to the Americas mm-hmm. and interacted here with the religious lives of those that were already here, creating a much more complicated picture than the usual narrative of Columbus arriving, planting his cross on a beach, and claiming all of the lands that would be the Americas for Christianity. Mm-hmm. The story is so much more interesting than that. It's so much more fascinating and complicated, and that's what I wanted to tell.
Were you at all surprised at what you found in 1492?
I was, and I suppose I shouldn't have been, because it did not take too much looking to be reminded of this history that we all should have known all along. Mm-hmm. I think that the ways in which we talk about American history, we're drawn to the narratives that we have been taught all along. We're drawn to, in 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, forgetting that at the very same time, the very same year, the Jews and the Muslims were being evicted from Spain, and in many ways that created the situation that sent Columbus out across the ocean blue. And we forget also that what he found here was a people with a fully developed religious life of their own, mm-hmm. and the religious conflicts that followed were not merely a matter of colonization and conversion, but really an eradication of an existing religious worldview.
How does the factuality of history get so transitioned into mythology?
Well, in many ways, the stories that we tell and the stories that are recounted about religion, these are stories of power. Mm-hmm. These are stories told and maintained by those worldviews that come out on top. But that's not the entirety of the story. The other part of the story I try to tell are the ways in which the beliefs on the margins, minority mm-hmm. beliefs, mm-hmm. the ways in which they are resilient and can find ways of moving underground and influencing the traditions which have come to dominate them.
Yeah.
So it would be easy to tell this story simply as a matter of minority beliefs being wiped out.
Mm-hmm.
But what's more interesting is the ways in which they've persevered in ways that we may have forgotten, changing the dominant faith from within.
Ah, that's a great point. Peter, what are the religions that most Americans don't know were significant in our national history?
Probably the one that is most enlightening to people, just based on my work and the book being out now and other writing that I've done, is the idea that Islam has been part of the American experience for much of those 500 years. The first Muslims came with Spanish explorers, often unbeknownst to Spanish explorers, because Spain actually had laws intended to prevent Islam from coming to the Americas for fear that Islam would influence the indigenous population. But still, those with Muslim beliefs came, slaves from North Africa. And then throughout the following centuries, more and more came, again, under those conditions of slavery. Mm-hmm. It's estimated that 20% of Africans brought through the slave trade to the Americas had some connection to Islam when they arrived. And the story that then happens is that they are gradually Christianized. And again, this is an example of the ways in which belief moves underground. Mm-hmm. You find people writing throughout the 19th century of finding examples of Muslim slaves who found ways to, the word you often see is accommodate, mm-hmm. their Islamic beliefs to the Christianity that was then being forced upon them.
Mm-hmm.
So that is just one great example that is very timely, obviously, that a faith that is regarded now erroneously as an immigrant faith, newly making itself known in American culture, has been here all along, has as much claim to the American story as any set of beliefs.
I wish you would talk for a minute with our listeners about what we lose when we don't know the rich faith diversity of American history.
I think we have a tendency to think and talk about religion in a very monolithic way, not only in terms of our history and thinking that there's just this dominant Christian narrative, but in terms of our own individual identities. I think that within our families and even with just in ourselves, we are all shaped by all the religious ideas that bump up against each other through our own experiences. And by ignoring the complexity of our religious heritage, our multi-religious heritage, we simplify not only our history, but our own lives now. And we make light of the very many differences that define us.
Mm-hmm. I know, and I appreciate you saying early on that you like storytelling, and of course that is a powerful means of conveying truth. When you say we needed a new American history, I want to ask, one, what was wrong with the old one? But secondly, if you have a story in mind, a historical story in mind that explains the answer to that question better than just doing it as narrative, what is that story?
Well, in the first place, why we need a new history? I think that we've all been brought up and educated with a certain set of facts taken for granted, and they have not been willing to take seriously the religious experiences of those without power. So, for example, I recently wrote in the New York Times about this history I just explained to you about the long history of Islam in America. And many of the comments I saw from readers of my article about this was, well, maybe they were here. Maybe many enslaved people were Muslims, but that doesn't mean they had any influence. Show me one Muslim, one comment said, who signed the Declaration of Independence. And of course, you can't. That wasn't part of that history. And yet, the fact that they were not in power at the time does not mean that their religious influence was not significant in their own lives or on our national history. And so we need a new history, in part, in order to pay attention of the very real experiences of those who have not had power, the very real experiences of those on the margins. Because we know in other areas of culture, whether it's in music or in art or in literature, the experiences of those on the margins often end up being ultimately as significant as those on mainstream culture. And so the same is true, I argue in the book, the same is true of belief. We, as a nation, though we are a majority Christian nation, we have all, regardless of our own individual beliefs, we have all been shaped and informed by these minority beliefs that have always been all around us. And as far as a particular story I like to tell about the ways in which this process works, I'm particularly drawn to a story, in a way, a much lighter-hearted story than the horrific story of the beliefs of the enslaved being eventually vanishing in the American context. There's a story in the 19th century of a woman named Mary Moody Emerson, who, as it happens, was the eccentric aunt of Ralph Waldo Emerson. And Ralph Waldo Emerson, as many listeners will know, was the founder of the Transcendentalist movement of poetry, which is really credited with introducing Eastern religious ideas into American literature. What many people don't know is that it was his pious aunt, his pious Christian aunt, Mary Moody Emerson, who first encountered Indian literature from someone who had visited India and brought with him back to Massachusetts where she lived images of Hindu deities and told her stories about the ways in which Hindu literature influenced that culture. She was so moved by this and moved especially by the ways in which they complemented her own Christian understanding that she shared it with her nephew, who was at the time a student at Harvard and a budding writer. She shared it with him, and he was so taken by it that eventually he took up a study of Indian religious texts. He writes about it in his poetry. He passes a copy of the Bhagavad Gita, the Hindu religious text, onto Henry David Thoreau, who brings it with him to Walden Pond, where he, of course, writes Walden, and begins really this new moment in American literature. And so I'm moved by the ways in which ideas move from person to person. I think we often talk about religion in terms of denominations and communities, but the ways in which ideas move is often very intimate. It can just be from an aunt to a nephew, the passing of a book from one hand to the other. And that is the way religious ideas have always moved through our history.
That's a wonderful story. Why are we so afraid of discovering history as it really is?
That's the perfect word for it. We are afraid. There is fear of complexity, fear of undermining the stories which we have always been taught. And I think that fear is the fear of feeling marginalized oneself, the the fear of feeling that one's own position, one's own connection to American history might somehow be lessened or diminished by allowing more and more influences to be recognized as a part of our common past. And yet I like to think that by approaching the subject through stories, through the compelling tales of individuals, I like to think that that is a way in which anyone can approach the subject and come away from it changed and moved and recognize that, well, no, in fact, it's not challenging to my own sense of identity to learn that there have always been Muslims in America. In fact, it enriches my understanding of difference and where we all came from if we are able to open ourselves up to that new information.
Religion obviously makes a lot of positive contributions in our lives, but of course there are always harms that are possible as well. I wonder, are there any religion-driven mistakes in American history that you think are particularly significant?
Religion-driven mistakes? Well, that's a interesting way to think about it. In a way, I think that everything is religion-driven. I think religion plays a part in all aspects of our culture. And so you can find the ways in which religion has been beneficial and harmful in many areas of American life. And one way to think about it especially is one example is the way in which religion and race has always been entwined in American life. Religion and race have always contributed to each other in terms of identifying difference and creating the sense of fear of those who are different. And so that is one way in which religion certainly has compounded our sense of difference.
Yeah. What would you like a reader to feel or to think after reading One Nation Under God's?
Well, I should say that it is not a book that is that anyone could say is anti-American. In a way, it's very patriotic book. In fact, it has a red, white, and blue cover, and that is not at all ironic. To me, it seems that a better understanding of American history, a better understanding of the richness and diversity of American history, can really add to our understanding and our appreciation of what we have built here, almost against the odds. And so I'd like to think that a reader might begin the book challenged to rethink what we previously understood about our collective past, but then come away feeling that, in fact, we are on the right course, that somehow, almost despite ourselves, this great diversity of beliefs that make up the nation has really led us to where we are today and hopefully to a better future.
That is so well said. Dr. Manceau, did writing this book change at all your perception of religion's role in the nation? And the larger question is, did writing this book affect your understanding of America in a different way? I'm really wanting to get at, what did writing this book do to you personally?
Well, I was raised in the Roman Catholic Church, and so I was raised with a very clear set of understandings about the differences between different groups of religious believers, both between Catholics and Protestants, and between Christians as a whole and all other religious traditions. And in the course of the writing of this book, I came to see that as much as denominations and different religious affiliations have always been important to Americans, I came to see the ways in which the interesting parts of our history are when those different sets of identities rub up against each other and influence each other. Religious studies scholars refer to traditions influencing and blending with each other as syncretisms. And to me, it seemed that the history of religion in America is really a syncretic history. It's really this story of all these beliefs coming together in a single place, a vast place, but a single place nonetheless, and changing each other over the course of centuries. And it has not just been the case that it has been the dominant faith that has changed all those in relation to it. Really, the dominant faith has been changed by every new tradition that has entered the country as well. And that really changed my understanding based on my own set of beliefs that I was raised with, and it changed my understanding of the nation as a whole, of its history.
With several award-winning book titles to his credit, Dr. Peter Manceau is an influential thinker and educator, currently curating an exhibit on America's diverse religious past for the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History. He's just published One Nation Under God's A New American History. Occasionally, very seldom, but occasionally on this show, I say to listeners, this is a book that you need to go out and buy, even if you have to sell a shirt to do it. This is one of those books. It's a great book. It's vitally important. And I think, listeners, if you read this book, you'll find out something new that makes you appreciate America even more. And you may find out something that makes you feel even better about your place in this nation. Peter, thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
It was my real pleasure. Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. The ongoing financial support of State of Belief listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air, to keep these conversations going so that you and others can hear them. I want to thank you if you've made a donation this week. If you find value in what we're doing, then I urge you to join our other generous supporters. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Don't wait. Do it today. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/stateofbelief. Share the stories you hear on State of Belief with your friends. They are compelling stories. Your friends need to know about it. You'll do them a favor by talking with them about it. We're also at twitter.com/stateofbelief. Look, this is not a time that we can take anything for granted. If you find value in what you hear on this show, please spread the word about this show. And of course, keep listening yourselves. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.